I was just up at Ananda Village again. I think every time I talk to this class, I've just been up at Ananda Village, but it's been that way for the last 4 months. I think this was my last little teaching trip for a while. I was teaching to the yoga therapy students, which is always fun. I do it a few times a year. And usually I go up and I teach, like this time I would drive up Monday, teach Monday night, Tuesday morning, and then come home. But sometime around dinner time, somebody mentioned to me that Gyandev was in the middle of a week, or not in the middle, but wherever part of the week they were, probably the beginning, since it was Monday, teaching a Gita class, a week-long Gita class. And tonight was the night where he dressed up and he told the story of the Gita. So I thought to myself, oh, this could not be more perfect, because I was going to come back late last night. Every other Tuesday, I teach a two-hour Gita class to a group of women privately up in Atherton. And but I moved it to Wednesday because I was away. So I was teaching the Gita this morning and the Gita tonight. I thought, great, I'll just go and I'll hear what Gyandev has to say, and that'll be my class. In fact, it wasn't like that, but the reason why I'm telling you is he did a brilliant job. It was really remarkable, and he was all dressed up. But he spent, of the 2 hours, he spent 1 hour and 40 minutes talking about the Mahabharata, giving the prelude, or this, what, you know, the Gita's very, very tiny little piece of literally what is the longest epic that's ever been written, which is the Mahabharata. This is a tiny little piece of it. So he spent all of this time talking about the Mahabharata. Then he gave us a little break, and then it was 20 of 9. And I was sort of wondering what was going to happen here, because I'd been up since 4 in the morning. And I thought, there's no way in the world he's going to tell the story of the Bhagavad Gita in 20 minutes. But I'll be darned. If he didn't perfectly, I'm so sorry I don't have it recorded, because what he did, in essence, was say, here's what the Gita is about, and he hit every main teaching, just like that, boom, boom, boom. It was brilliantly done, absolutely masterfully done, and we walked out at 9 o'clock. What was really remarkable to me about the story of the Mahabharata, which of course I've heard, I'm sure many of us have heard at least to some degree, is that I realized, now again, although it's all allegory, you know, and I know we've been saying this and we all know it, but I just want to preface what I'm about to say with this again. It's allegory that's sharing with us the most important lessons of our lives. Obviously, every bit of wisdom that we would need to become a realized yogi. And as he told these stories, and he played all the parts, and it was very entertaining, but it was so compelling to me to realize how hard everybody tried to not have to go to battle. What an extraordinary effort there was, which is a great part of the Mahabharata, to not have to have this war. Now remember, we're talking about a war that ultimately, and this is the point, that we all need to fight. That with every great effort everybody made, including Krishna himself, Krishna came to Dhritarashtra, the blind mind father, who had by now given over, you remember, all of his power to Duryodhana, his son. And Duryodhana was not a very good man. He represents material attachment in the Gita. So he's not going to give up his hold, and I know we all know that now. But Krishna comes, and he's imploring in the very end, after all of these stories go on for all this time, God himself comes and says, please, this is all you need to do, and you won't have to go to war. You won't have to see all of this slaughter, this killing. And Dhritarashtra's just sort of there saying, what can I do? I've really given my power away. I'm totally out of control. There's nothing I can do. It was so, I said compelling, but it, you know, you read a story, you read a story, you read a story. It just came to me as I was listening to him, how hard the spiritual path is, how much we have to, no matter what we think. And I know I said this 2 weeks ago at the beginning of the course, but I'm saying it again because I got it in a new way. Just what an extraordinary battle that we need to do, and how many perfect rationalizations we have over and over and over in life to not do it. For those of you who were here when I just gave Sunday service on, who was here Sunday? Okay, so, but I told a story that Asha had told the week before, and the reason I told the story was because it was about a story about how much her father loved her. What a great little girl she was. She wasn't saying that, but she was, obviously. She was probably like a little Shirley Temple. And here's this Jewish dad, totally in love with his daughter. And when she was 18 years old, it came to her that she could no longer relate to him as father the way he wanted her to relate to him as father. That every expectation in life up until then, this man had loved her so well, had been devoted to her, had cared about her. Everything was perfect in the story. Nobody was doing anything wrong. In fact, he was living life perfectly, as was she. And then, when the moment that he realized that he was going to lose his daughter, as Asha said now 2 weeks ago, through tears of her own, it's the first time I ever saw my father cry. And the reason the story is so meaningful that I will tell it over and over is because it's what we're up against in life. It's all right. It's perfect. It's not like anybody was doing anything bad, wrong. People weren't lying, stealing, cheating, just amassing huge amounts of wealth. There was no greed. There was a father loving a daughter, and then the daughter just simply couldn't be there because she realized that she needed to find her heavenly father. So it's not that she left her father, she didn't quit loving her father, but what he expected in life, how he thought life was going to unfold, disappeared from him. And though, so that story, and then being up there and realizing what an amazing battle this is because of the way we rationalize. What is the first thing that Arjuna says to Krishna? He says, what about ahimsa? What about nonviolence? He goes right to a perfect and real spiritual teaching. And if we're not really deeply attuned and really very highly evolved or have a great teacher, somebody would say, yeah, what about ahimsa? We make these arguments that look perfect for us to not have to do battle with all of these qualities, so that our spiritual qualities in this story, represented by his brothers, right? We were talking before, Biraj was talking before about calmness. He mentioned peace and calmness. Peace, of course, being a more passive side of calmness. Swami says, and well, Master says, one of the major goals on the spiritual path is to be calmly active and actively calm. And it's the actively calm. Peace is a much more passive feeling. And those of us who just took the chakra class, we talked about that a lot. But calmness is such a dear quality. I mean, it's represented by Yudhishthira, who's the oldest brother. He's the closest that we ever get. He had one dice game after another dice throw after another dice throw, and no matter how much he lost, he just kept throwing the dice until he finally actually gambled away Draupadi, his kundalini. He lost himself. He basically lost himself in the dice game. And the question actually comes later in the Mahabharata. Draupadi says, when she's being... So all the bad kings, now everybody's going to decide who gets her because Yudhishthira has gambled her away. And she said, wait a minute, can that throw of the dice be considered legitimate? Because he had already lost himself. He wasn't even there in a way to be gambling anymore. it's a very fascinating story by story by story. So Krishna, of course, has to answer Arjuna about ahimsa, and he has to talk about what we've talked about before, about the difference between... Really what he talks about is how ahimsa is an attitude. It's not in the act. Because as Swamiji says, when he's in his commentary in this Gita, he says, in this day and age, it's virtually impossible to live completely in terms of ahimsa. Sri Yukteswar has a wonderful, wonderful phrase in here. Let me just take a moment and see if I can find it. He says, trying to see if I can just remember. He says, the world is inconveniently arranged these days for ahimsa. I mean, how can you, you know, you're driving cars and you hit bugs, you're walking along, you step on bugs. So, of course, it's almost virtually impossible to be completely nonviolent. But it's an attitude. And Krishna is saying to Arjuna, you're not with great animosity and hatred going after your cousins to kill them. You're killing them because if they live, and of course we've talked about all this, they will do more harm. So it would be like standing there watching somebody with a gun getting ready to kill 10 people when you yourself, in fact, could kill that one person who's doing evil. And it's a much longer talk than we have time for tonight. I remember listening to Asha talk once about a letter that Swami wrote. It's probably in his book of letters that's been published now. In fact, I think it is. Right after 9/11, he wrote a letter to somebody who was saying, how can we be angry at these terrorists? How could we want to kill the terrorists? How can we feel anything about them if we're practicing ahimsa? And Swamiji basically says there's not a spiritual path in the world that condones evil. You know, we're not supposed to stand still and just let ourselves be destroyed. Hence the whole story of the Bhagavad Gita. So I just wanted to somehow bring that to you. Again, it was... I felt like I felt it in a whole new way as I watched Giondev do it, that there's no way to avoid this if we want to go where we say we want to go. And it's not that we think that we're there, we're not there, but we're heading there. And in a way, Megan, in response to the point that you were making earlier and the question that you were asking, what about our desire for God? You know, and you sort of affirmed, which I'd like to have an etch-a-sketch pad if I could. I want to erase that for you in a way. Oh, no, I don't expect to make it in this life. Who knows? I remember Devi, Jyotishan Devi, the spiritual director. Well, they're more than the spiritual directors of Ananda Worldwide now. Jyotish is Swami's successor, which is quite a thing, quite a thing. So they're highly evolved people. And Devi said to Jyotish once, or around in Jyotish's company once years ago, if I'm not getting this exactly right, it's close enough. She was saying to somebody, oh, I don't really expect or think I'll make it to be fully realized in this life. And Jyotish just stopped her and he said, I think you better come up with a plan B because I think God has his eye on you. He just stopped her. I mean, cute actually, and cute when she tells it. But because we live in terms of the law of karma, anything that we desire has to be realized. And it's the law of karma. And the law of karma cannot be broken. It's the law upon which the whole life of our soul is based. If we desire a motorcycle or to be a motorcyclist or to take a certain trip or to have a lot of money or to be able to do any particular thing well, we're going to have to keep coming back anything. Swamiji asked Master once, is this even true about an ice cream cone? If I want an ice cream cone, I don't get it. Master said, absolutely. Seriously, he said, absolutely. Any desire we have has to be realized. So what that means is that if we hold that desire to know God, now we have to want that first. Some of us may be confused about it or just not feel that we want it. But if we want it, it has to be realized. Once we say that we want to know God, we will know God. may not be in this lifetime, may not be in the next 100 or even the next million lifetimes. We don't know. But it has to be realized. So holding that up, and it doesn't mean we can just do that and stand still. If we just make no spiritual effort at all, we will not move forward. It will take longer. But with any spiritual effort, any at all, because the instant that we have the desire to know God, it sets into play a whole string of events that's the opposite of what Amy was talking about. And eventually, in that downward spiral, which we read 2 weeks ago, Sunday service from the Gita, I don't have the reading here, the final line was annihilation of our spiritual life, which I can't go into this, and it's just not the point here right now, but in an expanded commentary, Swamiji shows us why it's not complete annihilation, lest we think we could actually do that. He says that's virtually impossible, and he explains in a different way what Krishna is, which it is meant to. But the next week, Swamiji turns it around. Here's what one would do to not go down that path, to be that lost. And he starts talking, and I don't have it totally in my head right now, but he basically says, the first, talk about what's obvious first, is that we all have to know where we are on our spiritual path and what looks forward for us, because it is different for every one of us. And if we get into this trap that a lot of people on a spiritual path get into, that there are rules that you have to abide by, and of course there are, I mean, because the word dharma is in here, so you can't be out there gossiping or treating people badly or stealing. I mean, this is how the Ten Commandments, and I mean, it's all over the Gita. We'll read it in the next little reading, some of it. And it was in the reading that Biraj did tonight. So we're not talking about allowing ourselves out. We're saying, let's assume, because remember, the Bhagavad Gita is not speaking to people who just want to do good things in the world. This is not a scripture that's written for somebody who just wants to be a nice guy, go and do a little volunteer work on the side and call it a day. It's not like that. And it's very clear. Krishna is right out there, right from the very first chapter of the Gita. He is speaking to his main disciple, although it's all of us. And he's saying, this is what you do to get to God, nothing less. So the bar is high in the Gita. Although, as I said to you 2 weeks ago, and we'll see in the next reading that I do tonight, what's so touching about it is how compassionate and nurturing and accepting we find that God is as we're all sort of tripping down this path, doing our very best. But given that, so given that we're all on the path, that we're all really looking to find God, and that we're willing to take risks, and we're willing to stretch ourselves and fight the battle, but whatever our battle is, to see what's out there next for us and to take those steps. It says, for the restless, service may be more beneficial than meditation at times. For the lazy person, activity would be better. So to serve through karma yoga might be better for certain people than to meditate. I always joke about my husband because he just finds it so hard to meditate. So he started to have this line with me. He tells me all the time, God doesn't want me to sit still in this lifetime. He says it to me over and over, like he's going to pull in, you know, this divine intervention. No, God doesn't want me to do this. So, honey, God does want you to do it. You don't want to do it. There's a little bit of a difference here. But it's very hard for him to sit still. So I have said to him, and it's true, then as you're moving, as you're doing everything that he needs to do, he is a man in action, think about God. Try as often as you can to offer what you're doing to God, whether it's cleaning a window, cleaning the floor, helping your children, doesn't matter what it is. Do it as a true karma yogi. But what this reading says is that for each person, it's going to be different depending on our own tendencies. And we need to find that because otherwise we will wind up hating the path we're on. And this is very important. We will bring so much resistance up that we will lose spiritual ground. When I was at the village yesterday, there was a woman who wanted to talk with me. I think very smartly she wanted to talk to me because I don't live at the village. But she was telling me about, she's been pulled a little bit into a relationship. So she lives at the village, she's been at the village, but she's pulled into a relationship with somebody who's not just not at the village, but not on this path, not on any path, never really thought about anything spiritual before, although he sounds like a lovely guy. And it was very interesting for me sitting there with her because she, of course, wanted me, I totally understand this, wanted me to say, this is a good thing. Absolutely, follow your heart. Go with it. You haven't been with anybody in a long time. And in essence, I kind of said that to her because I, although not just like that, I inserted a little bit of caution and some guidance and really some tools she might use because I knew that if I were to say to her in that moment, don't do this, then we'd really be in a bind. She would probably feel like she had to listen to me, and I could see that it would only make her angry, not at me, but at the path. And I knew that that would get her off this path much sooner than following this, whatever it is. I mean, who knows what's going to happen? This is how somebody probably coined the phrase, God only knows. I don't want to say that I can predict, but there's a good chance that I could predict how it's going to go. I don't mean that arrogantly. I mean, anybody, if you heard the whole story, which isn't important here, what's important here is that I wound up saying to her, go for it. Go ahead. Just, you know, keep your books with you when you travel and keep Swamiji's music around you and, you know, keep coming back here and think about bringing him here. Because the truth is that to the person who is more rajasic or just more wound up or can't find a certain vibration. So if I say to somebody, oh, I can't stand that music. There's so much music I just can't be near anymore. It's just horrible for me. But I realize that for some of those people, hearing Swamiji's music all the time is just as annoying. If they're not attuned to that vibration, you know, it's very difficult coming at this from both ways. So what we need to do is say, where are we? What is our next step forward? What's going to help us the most, each of us? And it never necessarily, or even really ever, looks exactly the same for any two people, which is a lot of how I have made some progress, I think. Probably many of us have made progress in being less judgmental of people. Because you realize that they're doing the best they can do, I'm doing the best I can do, and for all I know, they're going to beat me to the finish line. You know, it's just we're all climbing the mountain on different paths. We're all headed to the top of the mountain. There are many ways to get there. But to really pay attention and know our own path matters. And what is Krishna really saying? He's saying the only way we can know that is if we go inside, if we find it intuitively, that the more that we meditate, the more we get still, the more we come to that center, I mean, exactly what we were reading before class, that we'll find it. There's no one path, right? Swami Satchitananda's phrase, truth is one, paths are many, just has so much wisdom in it. The paths aren't the same, but the underlying spiritual principles are the same in every path. And that is important to know. I wanted to read to you. Darn it, now I just lost it. Give me 1 minute. I wanted to read Swamiji's commentary from the Gita. He's talking to Arjuna, again, about why battle. And he's saying to him, nothing is more propitious than for a kshatriya, that means a warrior, and that's the class that Arjuna is, whose duty is to fight for righteousness, to battle for what is right and true. This is right from the Gita. This is not commentary. Blessed and fortunate are you if you must give even your life for such a cause. Such a death will open to you the gates of heaven. So he's saying, this is your dharma. And even if you die doing it, once you see what your dharma is, and it's yours, far better to die in the process than to never have made any effort. Once we know what it is, he's saying, you have to go forward with it. A slain, this is now Swamiji's commentary. He says, a slain warrior who has fought fearlessly in a good cause goes to heaven as a result of having held to an ideal higher than material existence. His willingness in a righteous cause to sacrifice his lower reality for a higher one entitles him to enjoy the beautiful astral regions after death. So there's several teachings here, but basically saying, find your dharma. Once you find it, then you have to be willing to die doing it. To die doing it, because he says, if you're killed in battle, you will attain heaven. If you win this war, you will obtain earthly glory. Arise, Arjuna, determined to fight. Be even-minded in the face of pleasure or pain, gain or loss, victory or defeat. In this way, you will incur no sin. So what they're saying here is you can't lose. You cannot lose if you find your dharma and you go for it in a righteous way. And that really, there's nothing else to do. You can't fight somebody else's battle. You can't not fight your own in terms of moving down this spiritual path. Each of these lessons is very profound, and it doesn't make it easier, but it's simply the truth. We don't have to do it. It's like sort of the answer when somebody asks Swamiji, do you need a guru? No, you don't need a guru. Unless you happen to want to know God, then you need a guru. Do we have to do our battle once we see what it is? Whether it's overcoming a certain fear, whether it's resisting a temptation that grabs us, and it can be a temptation to move out into the world and do something that we probably know deep inside to be wrong, or it could be a temptation to be lazy, to not be willing to overcome something within us that needs to be overcome. And the next reading I'm going to read is, how do we know how hard to push ourselves? Which is really a very important question. How do we know how hard to try? Which is a little too mindful, intellectual, general path. And then in our personal path, is that really we need to do the best we can do to be able to intuit what our path is. I mean, the classic story that Swamiji has told here that is so just brilliant is that, and I think you've heard me tell this, Lily, but Mahatma Gandhi, who was a lawyer, you know, before he got onto the path he was on, and then we all know who said, I've had enough of this life. I'm going to open a practice now. I'm really ready to make a... I mean, people would wonder, what in the world happened? That is not his dharma. And yet, if somebody who had never been able to realize their potential in a worldly way, who had been lazy, who could never himself, who was always too afraid to, you know, take an educational challenge even, said, I really feel courageous now. I'm going to go to law school and get a degree, and I'm going to do well in this world. It would be a real step forward for them. So there, no two of us are ever alike in terms of what's next. And I think that's the teaching here. Well, let me just say that I think that everything we're talking about here, whether we're talking about developing a law practice, or it's like when people ask me, and people do this all the time, how much do you do medicine? How much time do you give to the church? How do you feel about those things? They're one and the same to me. You know, I can't, it just feels to me like everything that I do is informed by these spiritual principles that I'm living by. And I think we do have a life purpose, but everything becomes a tool. For the yogi, everything is a tool. Every relationship, every job, every person that we serve, how we raise our children, how we are with our partners, everything becomes a practice for how to know God and love God. So they're not really separate. And so there's dharma in how we are in relationship with our partners. There's dharma in how we, clean the church after an event. I remember recently I was telling people that one of the things that I really have consciously seen and learned from and admire about David and Asha, both of them, is that they, and I'm talking now years ago when I first moved here, I would watch them create an event, clean up after event, get prepared for, even when we just did this wedding a few weeks ago, and some of you know the three of us did it together. There's not an undotted I or an uncrossed T anywhere. They do everything. Nothing is just good enough. Nothing is okay. Everything is done. Like I've been saying to people recently, I know Tricia and I have had the opportunity recently to be making sandwiches a lot. We did it when I didn't prepare for the lunch 2 weeks ago. We did it for the hike. And I keep saying to everybody who's working, we're all working together, every one of these sandwiches should look and be wrapped in saran wrap, right? As if you're about to go and hand it to Master. Because in essence, we are. So it doesn't really matter what we're doing. If we bring that to every act, you see, that is the absolute genius and inspiration in these sharing nature games that I've been talking about so much recently. Because when you stand there and you play that game, it's not a game. Somebody's behind you and they say, I am. And you say, the Bhagavad Gita book, I am the carpet that I'm standing on. I mean, it's much nicer in nature when it's a tree and it's the mountains and it's the wind against your skin and it's the river that you can hear. But it's true when you're making sandwiches. And it's true when you're looking at your partner and they happen to be irritating you in the moment. Or you don't know what to do with your children or whatever it is. The more we can see God in everything, that's our path. It's not... When I decided to go to medical school, I was 32 years old. My husband had said to me, there's only one rule I have. And after this rule, I'm with you 100%. I was already 32 years old. He had just finished medical school, training, everything. He was so done with that life. And here I was saying, guess what? I'm going to medical school. Dragging him right back in. And he said to me, the only rule is this, that we love and enjoy every moment of this process, that we don't think for 1 minute that what we're doing that's going to be wonderful is at the end when you have your MD and you're done with your residency. Because that was going to be the next 8 years of our life. Be in every moment, he was saying to me. What an inspiration. Really, it was probably one of the wisest things he ever said to me or to anyone. He's a pretty wise man. And that's what this is. This is saying there is no difference between our earthly purpose and going to God. It's all going to God. And you know, I'll tell you this, I wish I could quote this exactly. I'll just do this and I'll stop. I wish I could quote this exactly, and I won't get it right. If I remember, I'll bring it to you next week. But recently I was reading something Swamiji wrote. I don't even know if I could remember where it was. But he says, on the spiritual path, basically, energetic effort is always necessary. And again, these are words of a very great saint. That's the truth about Swamiji. It's not, he's not using his words thoughtlessly. Energetic effort is always important on the spiritual path. And that's, I mean, there you are, a living example. And it's like every time we just want to cut a corner, we have to be focused and concentrating. If what we're doing is making egg salad sandwiches, that egg salad sandwich becomes the most important thing in the world. And you know, just like your customers would really do that, when we went on this hike and we laid this picnic out on these two sheets, and it was a lot of effort to get to where this picnic was, a lot of effort. But to the person, everybody on that hike was just so touched by the effort that went into that food. They felt the love. It was like, oh my God, this is so delicious and it's so beautiful. Wait a minute, you mean you have more? You mean you brought that too? It was, I mean, am I exaggerating about this? It was an exquisite moment because people feel it, even though your customers will never know that you almost did what was just good enough. But that doing just what's good enough, that's who we become. And if we really say, no, I'm going to bring everything I have to this moment, and this moment, and this moment, that's how we get to know where to go next. That's the kind of effort that allows God to show us the way. We have to show up. We have to be there, or nobody can show us anything. Well, you know, this is way more. I want to address this next week. It's way more than we can get into, but you're really talking about, is there such a thing as evil? Are there satanic forces at work in the world? And all of these masters will say yes. So are people deranged? I mean, do people get psychotic and think that God is telling them to go into that school and kill 23 or 35 people? Yeah. Now, that's not what we're talking about, give up your life, you know, or the suicide bombers. I mean, what can we say? We know, you know, you will never find a true spiritual teaching that winds up creating that kind of, you know, and remember, this is an allegory. We're talking, it's different. But I mean, here we're talking about life and death. No, there's much more to say about this. It is very hard. But, and you know, I think for most of us wouldn't be ready. There's one story about a guru who, a disciple came, climbed high up in the Himalaya to find him and said, I want to be your disciple. And the teacher started saying, you're not worthy to be my disciple. And the disciple was begging him, please. He said, if you don't take me as your disciple, I will jump off this cliff. And the master said, go ahead, jump off the cliff. And he jumped off and he died. And then he said to the other disciples, go get his body and bring it up. And he restored him to life and actually gave him, you know, touched him on his forehead, and he had an experience of samadhi. But these are stories. Most of us, we're not there. You know, we're really not there totally. But we're working real hard at it. We're changing our life as we know it. We're risking having friends and family and other people be hurt and angry with us because they wish we would just go out and have a drink with them every once in a while. And why do you have to be so serious about this? And what do you mean you can't go away with me to Europe for 3 weeks? And no, I really don't want to leave my spiritual home for 3 weeks to go shopping in Europe. You know, it's just, and people get hurt and people don't understand. And so in a way, we're letting parts of ourselves die, you know, but we can't get confused between good and evil. And that I think is when we're talking about suicide bombers, that's where we are. I'm going to stop now just to make sure.